Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Threatside Podcast. Today, I am joined by Delirious.
Hello, everyone.
And by a special guest by the name of Chase the Light.
Hello.
How are you doing, Chase?
Oh, not bad, thank you. How about yourself?
Yes, I'm good. The one and only developer of the Light Tracer bot.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely has its pros and cons. It's fun working on it, I suppose.
It's an amazing tool, though. Very, very good. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and your overall personal story?
Yeah, sure. So I've always been a automation engineer. I mean, I'll be completely honest, it's not like I had a very, very extensive career before transitioning into Web3. I only have about, I'd say, a year and a bit of traditional 9-to-5 experience, I suppose. But during that time, whatever team, I was working as a software engineer primarily, but whatever team that they would put me in, I would somehow just pivot as being the team's automation engineer. And even back in university, all of my major projects were automation based. But my journey was essentially, I kind of had, so I did the 9-to-5 for a while, and I will be completely honest, I don't think it was really for me. I didn't really enjoy it that much, and I did actually kind of want to transition away. But I was quite fortunate in the sense that even before I was still a university student, I did have some Web3 security experience. So I did work as a manual auditor for a short period of time, and I really enjoyed that, and enjoyed that work a lot more than my 9-to-5 work. So after, I'd say, about 8 months, I kind of devised a plan for me to just transition fully back into Web3 security. And I had three criteria. So the first criteria is essentially I would do Web3 security work on the side outside of work hours. The first criteria which I had to meet was the money that was coming in on a monthly basis, it had to be half of what I was making in my 9-to-5. And the second criteria I had was I had to maintain that for 2 months straight. So if for 2 months, two consecutive months, I was making half of what I was making in my 9-to-5 outside of work, I was doing my Web3 security work, then I'll basically get the green light to pull the trigger and submit my resignation. And that's essentially how I fully transitioned into Web3 security. But yeah, I was always into security and automation and software development, and building LightChaser was essentially a combination of all three. So that's the path I went down.
Amazing. So, like, generally, like, if people go into Web3 security, like, everyone basically goes directly into manual analysis of the code. So tell me, well, why, like, okay, I guess that part of that is just your background and in automation, but how it was that you didn't, you know, decide to jump into the manual analysis and you, like, straight went up into writing your bot? Because, like, at this time when you started, it was not really that popular.
Absolutely. I mean, that was honestly quite a big decision which I had to make, because, and this is something I did tweet about this quite often at the time, is that I did essentially have a choice of going down the manual auditing path or the automated auditing path. And if you actually just look at the figures, going down the manual auditing path, typically speaking, is the standard and good path to take because of how much demand there is and how big essentially the pay is there. But if I was being completely honest with myself, I far more enjoyed working on automation. And another kind of issue, like factor which played a part, was that at the time I already had LightChaser v1 built. I'm not sure if people know this, but I actually built LightChaser v1 back in late 2021, early 2022. So I already had a automation framework ready as well. And the time was really perfect, because this is about the time where Code Arena started the bot races as well. But I'd say if I had to say what the primary reasons why I went down the automation route, first of all, I definitely enjoyed it far more. And I knew that for a fact, because I had done both. I've done both working on, like I mentioned, I was a manual auditor in the past. And I also worked in automation security because I built LightChaser V1 at the time. And I far more enjoyed working on automation than I did manual auditing. And the second kind of reason was that a primary goal which I had at the time, which I do apologize if this sounds a bit arrogant, but I really just kind of wanted to get into something where I could become the best in that particular field, that particular niche. And because I had a lot of expertise and I had like a lot of general proficiency in automation, I felt like I could achieve that goal far easier going down the automation route.
Like, definitely this is very smart decision that you made, because you can either try to develop your weak sides or, you know, to leverage on your strong sides.
Absolutely. I mean, as cliche as it is, I would personally advise people to kind of focus on whatever that they have a lot of passion for, which for me was definitely automation. I was huge into automation. Like I mentioned, whatever team that they would throw me in, I'll just somehow, like after a few weeks, just become an automation engineer there. And the second is, I do feel that everybody kind of has a handful of skills that they are naturally a lot better at than like against their average. And if you can figure out what those skills are, I'd say it's far more fruitful for you to just lean into those rather than try to go down the path that you might be okay at, but you don't have any like natural talent at and or passion. Because if you don't have the passion, it's very, very difficult to put the thousands of hours into the field that you want to go down.
Definitely. I totally agree with that. I think that Zach Oberon says that whoever has the most fun wins. And yeah, like it's totally true. And how do you think, in what period of time can automated bots like really compete with manual researchers concerning security reviews?
So with automation, I'm not necessarily talking about AI. I'm talking more light chaser type automation. So one drawback of automation is that it can only detect issues that you've written detectors for. And a downside of that is there are plenty and plenty of vulnerabilities which haven't been seen before. And a automation like program wouldn't necessarily be able to pick up on those. So even though as time goes on, I feel automation will map more and more issues, there will always be very protocol specific and very high complexity vulnerabilities that manual auditors will always excel at. Obviously, I am an automator myself, but even so, I don't feel manual auditing is going anywhere anytime soon. And if I want to put some of my bias in, I don't think it will ever happen that manual auditing will completely go away, even if you give it 5 years or something along this line. I mean, this may age poorly, but it is genuinely what I believe. Essentially, what I think will happen is automation will kind of get better at capturing all of the vulnerabilities that have been seen multiple times in the past. But you know, though, that top echelon of senior security researchers, they will probably, I feel that because of automation, will be able to take a lot of those low-hanging and medium-hanging fruit away. The value of auditors who can capture those very high complexity bugs will go up. So I actually think the pay of senior security researchers will actually increase due to automation, not decrease. However, I do feel that the quote-unquote bar to be considered a senior security researcher will go up, because if, with all due respect, the manual audits that you provide can't exceed something that a top tool can provide, then you won't have a lot of market share. You will only really begin to get a lot of income coming in, a lot of clients coming in, once your work is at the bracket where it's in the complete league of its own above automation.
I definitely agree with that. To be honest, with all this in mind, do you think that the Web3 sector, the security sector specifically, will kind of suffer in the same way as Web2? I don't know if you have any experience in actual like Web2 security bug bounties, but a lot of the community is kind of annoyed at the fact that everybody uses autonomy tools now in Web2, because, you know, essentially manual hunting is a lot harder because a lot of people will just run scripts and find bugs. And then this creates a bit of a problem for people who want to become good security researchers in Web2. Do you think this could be a problem in Web3 as well, if the autonomous tools keep rising upwards?
Absolutely. I do think because like I mentioned, a big factor of automation that doesn't necessarily apply to manual auditing is that automation kind of sets a bar, unlike manual auditing, because with manual auditors, you can have the best manual auditors in the world, but at the end of the day, they can only look at one code base at any given time. However, with automation, you can infinitely scale it. So because of that specific difference, automation essentially sets the bar of you have to be above this level to actually start making money. And so the better automation gets, the longer it would take for new security researchers to get to a point where they actually begin to see money coming in. So I do feel that it sounds similar to what you were explaining with Web 2. A lot of the new people coming in were just running scripts because the amount of time and effort and work ethic it takes to get above the bar of automation is so long that a lot of the new people would just resort to using automated tools instead. And that is something that I do feel will happen with Web3 security as well. However, I don't necessarily see it happening specifically with closed source tools because they are closed source, so only people who have access to it can use those. But I'm not sure if you know this, but even open source tools have seen a lot of contributions recently. Yeah, shout out to Dravi. Like, he's an absolute legend. I believe he contributed like 100 plus detectors to analyze. So even the open source tools will consistently get better as well. But I definitely have a bias. I do think there would be a lag between closed source and open source in terms of complexity ceiling and detectors, I suppose. But yeah, I do think that Web3 will see something similar.
And what about the security researcher assisting tools? Like, I haven't seen many of them. I know only about basically like Pyrometer that just connects like static analysis, control flow graph, and a few other tricks to help you with auditing. We have Audit Wizard, but I do believe that there is this market for such tools, like, is basically non-existing. And this, like, potentially could really, really change the game. And personally, I only know about one guy, the Dravi that you were mentioning. I know that he writes some tools that helps him out. For example, to list him points of interest, you know, the maybe something that you should take care of or look into that might not be an issue, but will definitely help. So yeah, I think that this could be a really cool idea. And yeah, I don't know, maybe we will see your light chaser, some new version of it to, you know, those AI assist to understand the code and all these flashy tools that will just help you out. And maybe you will do a part of manual analysis. What do you think about that?
You absolutely hit the nail on the head with that. Like, that is actually a huge aspect of automation that I feel is underdeveloped right now. And obviously, this is some like, it's not out yet, but it is actually something which I'm actively working on. Isn't necessarily points of interest. I did a tweet about this that kind of hinted to this future feature, but the one thing which I'm working on right now, which I don't mind sharing at all, is that future light chaser reports will also recommend potential attack scenarios. Like, for example, let's say it finds a particular vulnerability. Because now V4 is far more context-based than V3 was, it will actually be able to show you potential like paths which could be exploited. And that could be extremely valuable to manual researchers, because then that will actually allow them to expand on particular vulnerabilities and find high or critical vulnerability findings based on a relatively smaller severity finding. So that is actually something which I'm working on as well, because I do feel that there's a huge need for that as well. And I suppose, like, when it comes to points of interest, right now I do have a detector class which is made to not necessarily find vulnerabilities, but find points of interest. But it's not something which I've build that many detectors for, because a huge backlog. So I will get to that at some point, but yeah, definitely hit the nail on the head with that.
Cool. Like, this, what you said, is just amazing. And I'm just wondering what kind of tools you are using, because, like, I guess that abstract syntax tree analysis, like, is not enough for that. And I personally only know, like, about the control flow graph analysis to detect vulnerabilities. Are there any other kind of tools that you are using in Light Chaser?
I'm not 100% sure if you know, but Light Chaser was actually built 100% from scratch. So it doesn't actually, it's not built on top of any existing tools. And I had a bit of a weird policy when I was designing Light Chaser, which was that I essentially banned myself from using, like, looking at any currently existing analysis tools, because I was kind of worried that I would be subconsciously influenced into making, and I would just end up making something that was very similar to what already exists. So all of the, I say, light years of tech is pretty experimental, and it's pretty funky the way it all works, if I'm being completely honest, because it's not necessarily based on any past work. Yeah, I'm not sure if that answers your question, but it's not necessarily using any exist. It's not built on anything that's existing, I suppose.
Okay, and what about like methods? Sorry, because I like name it inappropriately. Like, what kind of methods you're using? We have abstract syntax tree, we have control flow graph, we have like AI that can assist us. Any other methods that you're using that you want to share?
So when it comes to AST and control flow graph, so right now I don't have any AI capacity right now. It is something that I probably will implement at some point, but I doubt I won't necessarily go down the API route. If I do decide to work with AI, it will probably be local models and stuff like that. But when it comes to AST and control flow, so I actually do have my own implementation of AST, and I suppose it's a bit embarrassing to admit, but when I actually initially developed Light Chaser and I was competing with Light Chaser, I got asked in the DM, oh, does Light Chaser use AST? And I had no idea, because I didn't even know what AST was, so I had to Google it. And then I was like, oh, so that's what it's called, because like I have my own quote unquote like way of basically doing AST, because I have my own parser. That was pretty funny, but I think I have a bit of a hybrid model. So it's AST combined with regex, but I don't use regex. I have my own version of it, which I wrote, which is a bit weird, but it's kind of a hybrid approach, I suppose. But I do apologize if I'm not explaining it well, because I don't really know how to explain it. But yeah, I suppose a hybrid between AST and regex is pretty close.
Okay.
I think it's actually good to have that sort of implementation as well, because not only is it unique, but you know it from the ground up. You're not just re-implementing something that's, you know, already generically known. For instance, you don't have to tweak it, you're just building your own version of it, and you're making it work in a way that you want it to work, which allows you to be maybe more efficient, let's just say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the reasons why I feel I was able to create so many detectors was because I created the entire framework, so I knew it extremely well. I knew all the nuances, and I think that gave me quite an advantage in terms of being able to reach the complexity ceiling of Light Chaser and the speed of development of new detectors. Because I as awesome as other tools, open source tools which I've seen are, I think one issue with them is that the flow of creating new detectors can be very time consuming, because obviously the people who are building the detectors aren't necessarily the people who built the framework. So it's kind of like harder to reach the complexity ceiling of the frameworks and code detectors relatively fast, I suppose.
That's a very interesting insight. I'm curious, what language did you code your bot in?
Oh, pure Python.
Oh, okay. That's very nice. Yeah. So I wanted actually to make a bot like a few months ago, and I was like a few people publicly on Discord, I can't remember which server, maybe it was like C4 as well, because there was people who were interested in creating their own bots. They were making them in JavaScript, for instance. And I was like, wow, like if I was making a bot, I'd also do it in Python, to be honest, because there's no Python inside out as well. And I feel like for automation, Python is actually really good. Like even when I was doing autonomy projects in Web 2, I was always using Python for them, literally every single time.
No, I absolutely agree. And there is a bit of a sentiment that Python is slow, but I don't think that is necessarily the case. I think if you code relatively well and you don't make the kind of mistakes which I did, I'll be completely honest, I had a lot of like recursion and iteration, which I replaced with hash maps slowly, but
yes.
I like all of the speed issues I was because I would just randomly have like n cube for loops randomly, like, and I slowly got rid of those. But if you code with, I'd say, speed in mind from the get-go, Python is just as fast as you need. You don't really need anything faster than that, I suppose, unless you like building something like Aderyn, because I think Aderyn is kind of designed to also work as a VSC, as a code VSC code extension. So if you have something that's running in real time as you program or something along those lines, then I think, yeah, going for something like Rust may be better. But if your tool has the same use case as mine, which is being the first stage of a protocol's order journey, then Python is perfect.
Yeah, definitely. Like, because you are running it once, and it, like, it doesn't really matter if it like runs for a few seconds or a few minutes or an hour. You just like run it once, deliver it to the project, and that's all. But what's more important in this case is the time that you need to write a detector for that. And I heard that you have over 900 vulnerability detectors, isn't it?
Yeah, I have 950 now. So I'm nearly at the 1,000 mark.
Oh my God. So my question is, when do you find time to sleep?
Oh, it's really like very... Okay, so I will give myself credit that I do take care of my sleep relatively well, but I'm not sure if you ever saw that meme where you can choose like three things. You could choose... Or so you could choose two out of these three things. Sleep, work / studies, and social life. So for now, at least, I've chosen work and sleep. So for now. As soon as, like, honestly, besides going to the gym, most of the time I'm always working. In fact, I'm not sure if you've seen this, but have you seen those GPT Win laptops? Those really tiny laptops. They're amazing. But I was actually planning... Imagine a laptop, but it's the size of... It's a little bit smaller than a tablet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really small, and I have these jackets called Scott Eres jackets,
mm-hmm.
and they're basically like a very, it's very much very practical jackets. It's very much a function over form, and they have like dozens of pockets like on the inside, and they have a really big pocket which you could put an iPad in. So I'm so obsessed with my work that I was actually planning this month or next month to get that tiny laptop, so even when I'm, let's say I'm on the bus or the train or something, I could take that laptop out of my pocket, start working, put it away really easily. So, I mean, that's why I said that passion is so important, because I feel you can only work that hard if you really, really enjoy it. But thankfully, I love working on light years.
Damn. So
sorry for the tangent.
Yeah. Like, oh. I can't really imagine myself like working on the bus with like some tiny laptop. You know, I have a widescreen monitor, and I got used to it so much, you know, and do with i3. Come on, like, really, what can you do on such a small laptop, man?
As long as it works.
I completely agree. But so the thing is, like, when I'm like programming detectors and stuff, I'd say kind of like my ultimate goal is to essentially separate myself from all of the work that isn't based on building Light Chaser. So something which I'm kind of working on is I'm trying to create a situation where anything that isn't directly building Light Chaser or developing detectors for it is done by others besides me. So I can just completely focus on Light Chaser itself. And because I like working on Light Chaser so much that even when I'm on the train and bus, that's all I really want to like do, essentially. I mean, another bit of a weird tangent, and I do apologize for all the tangents.
No, this is genuinely.
I will be honest, this is kind of cringe, but when I was building Light Chaser, especially then in the first few months when I was doing bot races as well, I used to like dream about coding detectors.
I knew it. I knew the dream aspect was gonna pop up.
I would wake up and I would quickly go in my laptop and just code up the detectors that I can unironically say. I can unironically say it was revealed to me in the dream. But I do apologize for the tangents. So, yeah.
No, it's great. I mean, it shows your perspective on a lot of things to the viewers as well. Not only just me and Del, but everybody who's watching this. And also shows a lot about your character. I think, like, you illustrate your thoughts very well, by the way. Like, you're very well spoken, especially about topics like this. So thank you for that as well.
Thank you. By the way,
I do have a question. From your point of view, do you think there was a lot of competition in the automated bot market? Or would you say that you conquer it? And at the moment, nobody can really compete in terms of quality.
So with automation, the competition, I would personally say, can be more fierce than the competition in manual auditing. Purely because, like I mentioned before, if you have an exceptional manual auditor, they can still only look at one code base at any given time. But if you are the best bot, audit bot, because you're an automated tool, you can infinitely scale and take the entire market. So, I mean, that is actually the primary driving force behind V4. So at the time, especially at the time, in order to kind of keep my position as amongst the best automated tools out there, I only really had to keep building V3 detectors. I didn't even need V4. Me simply just carry on building detectors for my current framework was essentially enough. The entire ethos behind building V4 was preemptively preparing for future competition. So, of course, I definitely have a heavy bias because I built LightChaser and it's the tool which I built. And so right now, I would say that I have a very strong, I'd say, standing in the current market. I have very good market share right now, like as we're speaking. But I'm not super like arrogant to think that, oh, it would be that like this forever and ever and ever. I will always have these clients. I'll always have this money coming in. I definitely have the humility to know that huge competitors can come out of nowhere and all of a sudden just wipe them all of the market share. Because like I mentioned, automation is scalable. So if a tool that is, let's say, twice or three times as good as LightChaser, they can like almost within a week just take the entire market. So because of that, I have like the humility to carry on building despite my high current market share. So that's the whole ethos behind V4. It's actually preparation for future competition, not current competition. So I definitely feel that automation is a very, very competitive market. And even if you do have a very good market share as of speaking, you can lose it quite quickly as well.
Yeah, that's actually very true. I would say that if talented security researchers who are strong in autonomy as well in Web2 would transition to Web3, mm-hmm. that would also be a lot more competitive in the automated bot market.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I if you are thinking about getting into automation, definitely do keep in mind that you can essentially never take breaks because a month in the automation space.
Yeah, that's like a whole
lot of time. Yeah. Like in the V3 bot racing days, the difference of 1 month was 100 detectors. But like definitely do keep that in mind if anybody ever wants to get into automation. But like I mentioned, if you truly enjoy it, you will actually find it more exciting. I mean, this is another, I do apologize, another tangent.
No, it's fine.
That I personally feel that having kind of a fire underneath your backside is extremely important in any field, but especially in automation. So during the more slow burning times, I actually share a lot of automation alpha with competitors, essentially. That is because I kind of want there to be a lot of competition. So I never take the foot off the gas. So that competition is very, very important. And in my opinion, is a very good thing to have. Definitely if Web2 automators come into the Web3 space, I definitely think there'll be a huge surge in competition. But I thankfully do think that I currently do have the humility to understand that and preemptively prepare.
I do think that philosophy is actually very good. Just having that constant, I guess, risk in a sense, just behind you, does make you just continue striving further. I genuinely just completely agree with that. I also live by that exact philosophy.
Yeah, but this is so common. So you are basically training your future enemies so that they can whoop your ass, maybe.
Oh, it goes like, I can't like talk about all of the projects I'm working on right now. That is definitely the case. You'd be surprised how many free consultation calls I've had with competitors.
That's impressive.
Thank you. And I don't really hold back either. When it comes to like, I tend to share pretty, I'd say, very, very useful stuff. And a lot of LightChaser tech has actually been implemented in competitor tools, including some open source tools as well. So, yeah, I'm not sure if you saw my YouTube channel, my Twitter account. But I tend to do architecture posts on there where I share like how the underlying architecture of Chaser works. And I'd say the combination of the architecture posts and the detector breakdowns, which I do, that's also kind of for the exact same reason. Because in my eyes, it's a win-win situation. Because on one hand, I get to share information with the community. And if you know Web3 is all about sharing knowledge. So obviously people can benefit from that. And like on the flip side, that increases competition, which then in turn makes me work harder, which then in turn makes LightChaser even better. So it's a bit of a weird chain reaction, I suppose.
This is amazing. And like, as you said, like everyone wins in this case. And like to anyone that is listening to this episode, definitely check out Chase Lai Twitter account. Super insightful. So if you want to do any kind of automation that and you want to inspire yourself, go ahead and check it out.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I would imagine this is also very motivating for people who were interested in making their own automated bots, even just letting them know that Python, just that in itself, they already are probably quite interested, especially people who already know it.
No, I 100%, with all due respect to programmers of other languages, don't let anybody, quote unquote, bully you into using a language that you don't like. It's far more efficient for you to build your bot in a language that you are the best at and you enjoy writing the most. And I actually have quite a lot of languages which I understand pretty well. I've done a lot of C programming as well, and obviously Python as well. Those two are my main languages. And obviously programming in something like C or Rust is a lot faster, like in terms of the speed. But you take a hit to your development speed.
Yeah.
So I don't actually think it's worth it overall, because let's say you have two choices. You can build it in, let's say, C, but it takes you three times as long. But then you can build it in Python. Yes, it would be slower, like the program would take longer to run. But the fact that you can implement new updates three times faster makes it well worth the trade-off. So yeah, that's my two cents.
I agree. Especially
if you are taking like months on end to develop your detector. So it's really, yeah, the only feasible option, right?
100%.
So I'm assuming projects reach out to you privately as well, right? Just to run your own script on their code base. And does that happen? Or
yeah, absolutely. A huge portion of my work is private work, private work. Mm-hmm. Which is obviously why I don't really tweet about it or anything for obvious reasons. But yeah, I'd say it's a big chunk of my client base, but still, like, one of I'd say the goals of I'm not trying to like generally take a jab at other automation tools and softwares out there, but one of the main, I'd say, motivations behind Lightchaser was essentially building something that was useful and valuable to security researchers. Because without mentioning any names, one thing that I would say that automation suffers from is that sometimes, like, the report that gets generated, a lot of the issues are super overinflated. And I'm not trying to make assumptions, but one of the reasons why I feel like that tends to happen is because when they hand it over to a end client, not an audit firm, but a protocol end client, they see that report and they get very happy. Oh, wow, it found a million highs. That's great. And because most of the time, they don't have any in-house security personnel, they can't actually tell the value of the underlying report. So when I was building Lightchaser, I wanted something that wouldn't like just appeal to protocols, but even an audit firm can look at the report and say, yes, this is valuable to us. So that was like a huge part of the ethos of Lightchaser, I'd say, like, which is why my primary clients are audit firms, because I kind of want to build something where it doesn't rely on wool over the eyes or smoke and mirrors or anything like that. Like, actual security people can actually look at it and say, yes, this is useful to us. Which, thankfully, so far so good. That has been the case from feedback I've received thus far.
This actually reminded me of a situation on Twitter that happened a few weeks ago. I think it was with Nerlin, wasn't it? Like an AI auditing firm or something. And it's like the bugs were just completely overinflated. Mm-hmm. So I definitely understand your point when you mentioned that. It's completely correct. Like the actual projects, they don't know the value of certain bugs. So when they do see just a ton of highs, even though they're completely overinflated, the project team is like, yeah, you know, thank you for finding this. Like, we would never find this. But, you know, deep down, it's actually just completely overinflated. And to some point, maybe it's also irrelevant depending on what bug is actually reported. Yeah, I definitely understand you completely on that.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm by no means saying this because this is also a negative. So definitely want to like say that first. But I've actually received more feedback that some of my bugs were underinflated than overinflated. Oh. So I've received more feedback that of underinflation than overinflation, which I'd say is a it's a better problem to have than overinflation, I suppose. But it's definitely also something I need to tweak, which I have. But yeah.
So how long would you say you've spent total on your bot in terms of hours? Do you think you could put a number on it?
If I had to guess, I would definitely say I've probably crossed the thousands by now.
Wow.
I would definitely have to say, because the detectors, those on their own, like I have 950, those take a considerable amount of time to make. But I'm not sure if I've communicated this a lot in the past, but a lot of the work which I put into Light Chaser, a lot of it never actually gets to see the light of day. I have so many experimental features and detectors that it's actually pretty crazy. So like, even though I spend a lot of time building detectors and framework upgrades that do get used, at the same time I also spend a lot of time with experimental features, and I tend to use them for a while, then I shelve them, then I'm making more experimental features. And another time consuming thing that tends to happen for me is this is actually a tweet which I made yesterday, so good timing. A lot of the times when I'm trying to map a particular vulnerability, I get a roadblock. The Light Chaser framework is missing XYZ feature that is required to implement this. I don't implement that new feature. I say, okay, fair enough, and I carry on. And then if that same XYZ feature that was missing causes three or more detectors to not be coded, then I add it to the next upgrade. But I definitely do try to manage the limited time that I have. But I will be completely honest with you that I tend to get carried away. So like halfway through building a detector, I just go off coding framework stuff. So the time which I spent is on experimental stuff as well.
That's good. That's actually good. So you probably can't even put a time on this either, but I mean, let's say you're adding in like a new detector, right? It can probably range from like a very short time frame to a very long time frame, right? Or do they kind of have like an average?
It completely depends on what framework version is required to map the issue.
I see.
So Light Chaser is a single framework. It's completely backwards compatible. So a V1 detector can be used with V4, V2 can be used with V4, and V3 can be used with V4. So just because I have Light Chaser V4 doesn't necessarily mean that all future detectors will use V4 tech. Mm. In fact, it's actually beneficial for me to essentially use the lowest version to map a detector whenever I have to create one. So it completely depends on the complexity ceiling of that particular vulnerability. So let's say a vulnerability is very complex, then I'll most likely have to use V4 tech to map it fully. So then if it's a V4 detector, that can take me a lot longer. But I suppose it depends on what framework I deem is necessary. So the easiest detector is obviously V1. I'll be completely honest with you. If it's a V1 detector, I can probably code it in 5-10 minutes. V2, I would say maybe 30 minutes, 30-40 minutes. Then V3 is like an hour, and V4 can be multiple hours, because V4 detectors are pretty crazy in what they're capable of, and there's so many moving parts in them. I only have 10 V4 detectors right now, by the way. Like, out of my 950 detectors, only 10 of them are V4. And that's partly because of how time-consuming they are to make. So I am actually trying to get a critical mass of V4 detectors, but I'm not sure how long that would take. That would maybe take me a couple hundred hours, perhaps, to get to that.
So in every version, do you rewrite the framework, basically, or is it just updates / tweaks?
So the way I kind of define a new feature is through... So a V4 detector, during its run, it does all of its V4 functions. And then once it's completed those, it actually devolves into a V3 detector. Then it does a bunch of V3 actions. Then it devolves into a V2 detector, does a bunch of V2 actions, then V1, then it finally gets submitted to the report. So the higher up you go, the more time complexity and computational power required. I'm not sure if that answered the question well, but...
No, I answered it. So I also know a few programmers that, create a tool, for instance, a script, program, whatever you want to call it, And let's say 2 years later, they completely rewrite it from scratch because they just feel like there's a completely different method of you know, rewriting it in a better way where it's more efficient, easier to understand, for instance, which isn't always required. But it, mainly the objective is to make it more efficient. Do you ever see yourself rewriting just full on everything or not really?
So one thing which I'm pretty grateful to my past self for is that when I was creating Light Chaser, I made it very, very functional slash like I followed the object-oriented programming standards very well.
Okay.
So it was already broken down into very small parts. And because of that, it was very easy for me to rewire the architecture as I saw fit. And so I have definitely made very huge sweeping changes to Light Chaser in the past, but it never really required me to rewrite huge sections of code. It's usually just smaller parts that were inefficient and stuff like that. This is a little bit embarrassing, I'd say, but I had like a upgrade which I did to the V1 architecture. So if you upgrade V1, that gives you the most bang for your buck in terms of the amount of time complexity saved in future runs. So one upgrade which I did was commenting out a piece of code. Like, it was some testing piece of code, but I forgot to comment it out when I was done. And once I commented it out, I think I got like a 40% speed increase or something crazy like that.
Wow, that's crazy.
And I am 100% sure I have artifacts like that scattered around. I just need to find them. I never had to rewrite huge sections of code ever. I know, I'd say one huge upgrade, which I did do, which definitely fits the bill, is moving away from iteration hash maps, essentially. I think that was probably the biggest rewriting of code I've done on Light Chaser. But besides that, the Light Chaser architecture was pretty rugged in the sense that it didn't need to... It wasn't super spaghettified that I had to make huge changes in the future.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. I do have another question, actually. Did you ever do, like, leak code, for instance?
No, never.
Oh, okay.
And you got right basically all the architecture on the first try. This is impressive.
Very impressive.
Thank you. I really do appreciate it. I mean, like, I one thing that I would say is that helped me was, like, if you kind of want to get really good with architecture, I think, like, stuff like chess and working on, like, puzzles and stuff like that can be quite beneficial because you kind of have to preemptively do things for future moves. You have to do like setup beforehand. And I do think that being very involved with those kind of things when I was younger kind of helped a little.
So do you still play chess now?
I don't play as much now. I mean, sometimes people on like Twitter actually challenge me to chess matches, which is pretty fun. So I do play from time to time, but I was super, super huge into chess. And a huge component of chess is essentially setting up future moves.
Yeah.
And because I played chess like every single day for years and years and years, I do actually think that kind of helped me when I'm like plan things out without having like needing a pen and paper to like plan out architecture or anything like that. Like, you'd be surprised to know that the underlying architecture, I've never written a formal plan for any of it. I pretty much winged the entire thing, but the entire architecture kind of just gets ingrained into my brain. And it never changes. It's just always like a map in my head that I can just like use whenever I need. But I think I developed that through playing chess a lot because chess works the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What elo were you in chess, just out of curiosity?
So I never had a proper formal rating. I believe on Light Chess I was like 1800, and they used to be a website which I don't know if it still exists called, I think, which is like you do a bunch of chess puzzles and it gives you like an estimate. I got about 18 something on there as well, so I say something around that.
Yeah, 1800 is pretty high.
I personally don't think it's super high because I still can really beat my dad. My dad's insane at chess. He's really good.
That's why I do like chess, to be honest. I would recommend it to anybody as well, especially for a security researcher, because it does make you think ahead in certain positions. And it's like you could be in a completely losing position as well, and you can still win the game in the end. It teaches you a lot about values as well, because obviously every single material on the chessboard has a value, basically.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is quite a lot of tactics, let's just say, which do benefit your kind of general way of perceiving things.
No, I 100% agree. Like, even when I was building V4, I had V5 and V6 in mind as well. So when I'm kind of like building a framework, I build it in a way that allows future upgrades very, very easily. Like kind of like a Lego piece. Like, when you, let's say each version of Light Chaser was like a Lego piece. Every time you stack a Lego piece on top of each other, the highest piece always has those four prongs to take on the next Lego piece. Yeah. That's kind of how I design things. Always keep upgradability in mind if you are building a book.
Amazing. So I'm gonna go ahead and buy my first Chess for Dummies book. yeah, we'll see. Super insightful. I was totally not expecting how this will turn out, this talk. Thank you for sharing everything with us. And now I think that we can go ahead and see, you know, what interesting stuff happened in March. What do you think, guys?
Sounds great.
Let's go for it.
Okay, so first one, we have Curio, which faced 60 million exploits. So what can I say? They had this vulnerability concerning voting power privileges. So it enabled them to mint excessive tokens and execute some financial maneuvers in order to gain 16 million for themselves and make 16 million loss for the protocol. So despite that, Curio announced a recovery plan and they plan to launch a new token, CGT 2.0. So yeah, we'll see.
Then there was also Prisma Finance that got hacked by 11.6 million. It was through a flash loan attack in one of their smart contracts. They lost 3,258 WST ETH tokens, which again had the value of 11.6 million. Very unfortunate that it is a flash loan exploit. I would probably say that they will still carry on happening for the foreseeable future. It's something that, you know, we want to prevent, but flash loan attacks, they're all very kind of targeted by black hats, let's just say. And I feel like with more educational kind of content out there regarding flash loans, it will always be a kind of lucrative edge to take for a black hat to just, you know, do a heist on flash loans. But this vulnerability specifically, I mean, it's pretty known. It was regarding input data for the flash loan function, literally just improper input validation. And it allowed the attacker to manipulate the input data where they were able to close and open troves on an arbitrary address and just extract profits, which is very sad. It's kind of interesting as to they were audited by. I don't actually know. But again, an 11.6 million loss, that's definitely going to make them want to go to a very credible auditing firm and get a very good audit. At least yeah. I hope. Like some projects don't actually learn, but hopefully they do.
Like, I guess what kind of auditing company could audit their code?
Let's not name them.
Yeah, but actually, like, the flash loan attack is such a broad term. So in this case, it's not like that they took flash loan and used flash loan for a leverage to do something. It's just they used flash loan because flash loan was not protected from external actors to execute. So yeah, actually, Chase, do you have any detectors for flash loans and how do you approach them? If you have.
No, so surprisingly, I don't actually have any detectors for flash loans at the moment. And one of the reasons was that flash loans attack chains, attack paths, tend to be quite protocol specific, and past versions of Lightchaser wasn't very good with protocol specific vulnerabilities. But with V4, I am actually hoping to map a lot more of these types of issues in the future. But so essentially, not right now, but hopefully in the near future.
Okay, and then we'll finally get rid of all the flash loan attacks if your bot will. all the code bases.
Well, like, if I can pull that off, that would be amazing. I mean, also, like, with something like that, I'd say once I built it for Lightchaser, if it's also possible on other frameworks, I might actually help, like, other open source frameworks implement a similar detector as well, because flash loans are such a prevalent issue that if we can kind of like band together to like stomp it out, that'd be pretty great.
Yeah, like totally agree. Yeah, and moving on, something that cannot be found by any automatic tools, which is Rogue Developer Exploit. This is one of the first exploits actually on the Blast ecosystem. Project Munchables lost like 62.5 million dollars. Yeah, and the problem was that the rogue developer who exploited upgradable proxy contract, you know, just get out with this money. So how he did that? He just like manually manipulated the storage slots and assigned themselves enormous ether balance before withdrawing. And come on, like, it's 2024 and we still have so much issues when, like, for the sometimes it just like private key breach, but we like actually don't know who got this private key. Sometimes we do know that this is developer, and my question is how can we do better?
I think with someone as like a rogue developer, you can't really. It's quite hard to prevent something like that from happening. Even if you have like a vetted developer, it's problematic.
I'd say like, just like Escrow mentioned, it's one of those vulnerabilities that is very difficult. It's not something that you can necessarily patch out. But I'd say like one thing that can be done is like implementing time locks for changes and like two-step procedures. So at the very least, like if a malicious upgrade is about to happen, users can see it preemptively and then make the decision for themselves whether or not they want to withdraw their assets or not. But in terms of stopping it from happening entirely, that is, I wouldn't even say that is something on the code base side. It's more KYC type stuff, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That is actually a good recommendation, though. We found a fix to the problem.
Yeah, new Lightchester detector confirmed.
Just put it on every audit and yeah, make sure it's critical. Make sure.
Like, oh yeah, that is like a pretty like funny point, because one thing with Lightchester, it points out privilege functions, and it kind of just by de facto just has that as a medium. And there is a lot of debate whether or not that should be reported at all. But the reason why I keep reporting it regardless is basically because it's still a very viable attack path. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, and what came to my mind right now is like, we have traditional companies, we have corporations, and they solve that problem. Like, developer is not a person that puts anything on production, in this case on mainnet. Developer doesn't have usually passwords to production. Like, if you want to do anything, it has to be approved by, you know, your manager or someone in charge. And here we are just doing Kiolo, and no one really cares about that. Come on, I do think that we need more Web 2 in Web 3, and not in the sense that we need more centralization, but we need, you know, some good practices concerning software development.
Yeah, like, no, I completely agree. I mean, a bit of a like meme, I'd say, is when people make a valid point like that, you tend to just get the response over so early.
Yeah,
I like as if it's a good thing, you know. I completely agree. Like, of course, like Web 2 isn't perfect at everything, but there are some things which they do far better. Which, like what you mentioned, these kind of exploits are far less common. And I think one of the reasons for that is a huge good positive about the Web 3 community is that it's very like anonymous and merit based. So if you kind of just like are anonymous on Twitter and you compete on like competitive platforms, like you do open source projects and stuff like that, you can basically make a very good living just getting freelance work purely based on that. But the downside is nobody, because you are anonymous, nobody truly knows who you are, and it kind of opens that door of like exploits, I say. But yeah, that's my two cents, I suppose. It's both a good and a bad thing, but the anonymity, but it's also a core part of the Web3 ethos is being decentralized, so it's a bit of a difficult one to.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely.
We also have Juice Staking, right? A JuiceBot app, I think, is their full name. So they were drained for around 1,303,811 Juice tokens, which is approximately 54 ETH. Not the biggest heist, but it's still, you know, pretty big. Ultimately, there isn't actually a lot of detail on this specific heist, but it was within their staking site. Ultimately, their staking contract allowed an attacker to just drain the liquidity pool and everybody's staked tokens. Now, emphasis on that enabled within their Medium article. I believe it was just, you know, a functional something with just improper access control, which just allowed anybody to take funds out, perhaps. I'm not too sure due to the lack of description, but 54 ETH was taken. So that's quite sad. And I would imagine that any auditing firm would actually pick up on that as well. So it's kind of interesting. I don't know who audited them, but I'm intrigued now, and I might have to check later on.
It's surprising how many vulnerabilities come about just because of arbitrary parameters and unvalidated parameters.
But I think people need to assign kind of more importance to that as well. Something like that can just go, you know, it can hide in plain sight very easily. So it is very important to kind of always check code and just find that.
Yeah, like I think 100%. That many people just don't know about this taint analysis. Like, this is super simple concept. It just says that every kind of input that you take, you have to treat it as it's being tainted, and then you are verifying it. And only if you verify if it has the proper value, then you are putting in through the sink, which is actually allowing it to you know, flow through your contract. And I do think that developers still have this Web2 mindset that you are writing code for use by yourself. And, you know, if you are writing some kind of backend or frontend, you are not usually thinking about some malicious actor being able to take your function and just execute it.
That's very true.
No, I 100%. I mean, I think this kind of it's linked to what Alex from Siphon said, where I think he made a very, very good post and very good point about smart contracts not being software, but rather it being hardware. And I think the way he kind of like explained it was really good, because he kind of talked about how, unlike traditional software, if there's an issue, you can patch it and kind of go about your day. With smart contracts, essentially, if you have an issue, there is no rolling it back, at least for the most part, because of course you have like upgradable proxy contracts and stuff like that, but
like door-to-door guarantee, something like.
Yeah,
this is definitely true. I never thought about it in this way, but definitely it makes sense. And actually, I had this post that we should really look into traditional architecture concerning like hardware, concerning like buildings, bridges, you know, how the people are making sure that this thing doesn't break, and like how can we put that into Web3 context.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you don't mind me asking, like, do you like how much Web2 experience do you have before transitioning into Web3?
Me personally, 10 years, I'm still a dev. So, yeah.
I have around 5 years in Web2 security. So I did bug bounties on HackerOne, bug crowd as well. And yeah, I'm only 22. So yeah, I've only got a few years under my name. But yeah, and then, you know, 2 years in Web3 at the minute, so not too bad. How about yourself, Chase?
5 years, honestly, 5 years of experience at 22 is mind-blowing. That's amazing. I'd say I have the least traditional experience of any of us. I basically only worked in a traditional firm for only, I'd say, a year and 2 months or something like that. Mm-hmm. So which is why I don't have the same kind of Web2 know-how an insight as you two have, but which is why I'm so interested when you like talk about implementing Web2 architecture into Web3. That's quite interesting to me.
It's very applicable, very, very applicable, especially from the code standpoint when we talk about Web2 security and autonomy mainly, because a lot of scripts in Web2 security are just autonomous. But that's also because a lot of things in Web2 are so technical that you do want them to be automated. Especially when it comes to finding specific bugs, right? I'm not going to go off on a tangent here, though, to be honest, because a lot of people don't also have Web2 experience. So I'll be using a lot of Web2 terminology, which is just will be irrelevant. Yeah, you would want to really automate a lot of the bug hunting in Web2, just as an example, just again, because it's so technical. Web3 is, again, not at that point yet, but we're going to head there in the future, probably, with the barrier just kind of getting raised every single time.
I mean, is there a good time for me to say we're so early?
At the minute, yes, definitely.
Oh my god. Yeah, like we are so early that we still don't know who Satoshi Nakamoto really is. Unfortunately, yeah. For Mr. Craig Wright, he is not Satoshi Nakamoto. At least according to US court, he said that he's not a Bitcoin creator. And I brought this story here because I read it and it's hilarious for me how many people are really trying to prove that they are Satoshi Nakamoto, and the easiest thing is just to send an email from Mr. Satoshi Nakamoto saying, hey, it's me, and the thing is solved. You don't have to do anything more. He has his email that he used to write emails from, like at the beginning. And, you know, if he really wanted to be known, he would be known. But my question to you guys is, What is your opinion? Who might be? Is it a single person, you know, a group of people, or who might be Satoshi Nakamoto? What do you think?
Go ahead. To be honest, I think I have a little bit of a tinfoil assumption, right? Let's just say that, okay, cool. You know, I do want to give credit to Satoshi Nakamoto. Like, it could be a completely real person that created it. And he's just completely anonymous now, you know, and he just done his job and that's it. But at the same time, I do think that it could have been a specific intelligence agency that created it. And, you know, they did it in a way where you can't really verify who the real person is behind it. It was just completely set up in that way from its fundamental creation. Yeah, that honestly, it's as simple as that. I think that it's either a real person that just went completely rogue, or it was an agency that set it up specifically. Because I do remember that digital money was spoken about in like the 1980s or 1990s even. There are like certain books published that do talk about it. So it's like, if you view it from that standpoint as well, it's like an agency that, you know, even in today's day has like technology that's ready 10 years in advance, or, you know, n number of years. It's like, it's a very probable theory that back then it's not really hard to create such a project with technology that the public doesn't even have access to at the time, or technology that they do have access to, but not to that extent that an agency does, if that makes sense. So that's kind of my theory about it.
Yeah, I mean, that is like really interesting and pretty similar to what I think as well. I also think it's more likely for it to be a group. I mean, if it was an individual, and also you see a lot of these individuals claiming to be him, I'd say if you really want to prove that you are Satoshi, all you have to do is send a transaction using Satoshi's wallet, right? I don't think it's more complicated than that. So I don't think it's an individual. I mean, and if it is an individual, I don't think they want to be known. But in terms of what organization it is, I mean, what you mentioned of it being an intelligence agency makes a lot of sense. But like, one thing that I do kind of think is, would it really be beneficial for them for there to be a decentralized currency such as Bitcoin?
I do think it depends, to be honest. We are going to go on a very crazy tangent here, to be honest. But
for it.
I mean, you know, when you think about it, it's kind of almost in a way about control. Like, if you have such a powerful asset that you do control just because you own like the majority of it, for instance. Like, also another aspect of it is coin, it's not really so private anymore as it was like so many years ago, because technology has advanced so much that you can just trace Bitcoin because of where it's going from, you know, exchange to exchange. For instance, you're sending it from just a normal wallet to an exchange. It's like, from a government standpoint, it's not really hard to find out who you are. So when you think about it in that way as well, it does allow them to just control a lot of the people in a way, see the outflows, see the inflows. Whereas with paper money, you don't really get that. You do get it with a bank account, but you know, paper money is kind of, it strives in the aspect where you don't really see, well, the government doesn't see how much you have, depending on how well you secure it. Whereas when it comes to digitalized money, it kind of opens up the barrier to the lack of privacy. And we also see a lot of privacy tokens get really bashed on, let's just say. Tornado Cash, for instance, right? The developer went to prison. Mm-hmm. That was all in favor of privacy. But then it was used, the argument against Tornado was that, you know, it promotes crime. It's used to fund like terrorism and stuff. And, you know, it's kind of a bit of a cliche argument, because you could say the same about Bitcoin in its early years. And that is exactly how Bitcoin got so popular, because of its anonymity. It doesn't really make sense. But that's kind of the stance that I have on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very valid argument, because it is surprisingly traceable, like even with Ethereum as well. Mm. Like, there isn't really any anonymity, in reality. However, The control that you do have is nobody can stop you from using it, which I definitely am in favor for. But nobody can, like, everybody can basically see what's going on. It's fully transparent in that regard. I mean, in terms of what agency built Bitcoin, one random, like, tinfoil hat or, like, theory which I have is that, like, it's some sort of like hacktivist kind of like collective who built it, because they saw the collapse of the current fiat system, and so they were kind of preemptively preparing for that. I mean, I don't think that is true completely. It's kind of cool to just think about. I play a lot of mecha games, and one of the games I was playing called Armored Core, there's a organization in that called the Legion of Observers, and they're kind of like in the shadows, and they're ultimately morally gray, I'd say. but their slogan is like for them to like intervene when necessary. So I kind of feel like it was just like a collective like that, that was kind of keeping an eye on things, saw the way the whole money printing and inflation was going and debt was going, and just kind of like preemptively create a system to prevent a collapse. But that's I don't know if that's true, but that is probably the most exciting thing to believe, which is why I believe in it.
No, I think it's a probable theory as well, to be honest. The thing is, when you do talk about topics like this, it's like you can go to like the craziest extent in terms of theories, and at the end of the day, they are plausible. Like, if they do make logically sense, then you can't really deny it, and you know, you can't really prove it, at least yet. So, you know, you can't really argue against even the craziest theories, whether it's about Bitcoin or Ethereum or, you know, whatever it is.
No, I can't completely agree. But like, if you give me a opportunity to come up with a cool, like, I could just like sprinkle in like mecha lore or something like that, I will. I have the saying right here. So their I'd say like slogan of the Observer: observe, prevent, intervene. So it's kind of like the SAP Foundation, I suppose. You can tell I'm a huge nerd when it comes to these kind of things. But yeah,
no, that's cool. Very cool. So we also have Super Sushi Samurai. They lost 4.8 million in a contract bug exploit. So the project is a game project on Blast, and they lost 4.8 million. Very sad. Relatively big number. Essentially, the bug allowed users to double their token balance by transferring tokens to their own address. So this is actually something that I do see nowadays in contests do pick up. It's not obviously it's not like super, super common, but it does still exist. I do feel like maybe bots pick it up. I don't know. Chase, does your bot pick this up, for instance, transferring tokens to your own address?
I mean, it picks it up, but not. It doesn't pick it up as something very severe. Like, there is a detector which I have which says prevent transfers to yourself. So prevent transfers from yourself to yourself.
Yeah.
But it doesn't list it as anything super major, because I think there was this paired with something else to make it into something more severe. I don't see how transferring to yourself can be a huge deal.
Yeah, the problem is that they are caching the amount of tokens you have before.
Yeah.
So removing that and then are overriding. So you are actually doubling the money that you have after transferring to yourself.
I should have gave more context, to be honest. My bad.
Yeah, this is such an old issue.
I have a point of interest detector which actually can help find this, and it's triggered on some recent contests. I have a detector which tries to identify donation attack vectors, and basically it specifically looks for when balances are cached before transfers.
Mm-hmm.
So that would actually pick this up. It won't necessarily pick it up as a vulnerability, but it would pick it up as a point of interest. Mm-hmm. So definitely something I can work on to like capture it fully.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, they had an audit from Berry Chains, and unfortunately they didn't pick it up.
So this is so strange, like, because you already have so much examples of fastest for ERC20. For example, I do believe that HorseFacts has like whole fuzzing test for web. So you are just like removing the, or you are just taking the transfer and transfer from part and total supply, and you are putting all those tests into your ERC20, and you are verifying if it works correctly. Like, of course those tests would find it immediately. I don't know. But concerning your donation, the attack vector that you spoke about, actually Kanakodu found this novel bug pattern in DeFi protocols, which is called stealth donation. So,
oh yes, yes.
Yeah. So you can use the safeguards of the protocol in order to hack it, because, like, of course, the normal prevention from the donation attack is that you do not rely on ERC20 dot balance off.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone knows that. So what protocols do, they are actually using some internal counter to track how much balance do they have. And this is cool. But the problem is that usually they are using that in order to mint some kind of shares based on the assets. So,
yeah.
And actually, all of the protocols, or most of the protocols, are rounding in favor of the protocol. So user gets less than they should. And this is the crux of this vulnerability. Because let's say that you are putting two tokens, and you are getting back, you should get back 1.5 share, but you are only getting one. So you actually donated one of these tokens to the protocol, actually. And the problem is that you can, of course, do some looping and increase that attack. And actually, we had like multiple protocols which were hacked. And actually, Wise Lending in January was hacked just because of this actual vulnerability. So not many people are knowing about that, and this is something that people really should know. The prevention from that is first to calculate how much shares to mint, and then again calculate how much amount to take from the user, and do not allow like this stealth donation. Yeah. Next up, we have actually not a hack, it was mitigation from the hack. The Hoshiari had this tweet, which was super cool. So actually, he was doing private audit of some protocol, and the protocol had some external dependency on ERC-4626 Vault. And what he found in the other project was that they do not use checks effects interactions pattern, which is one of the most basic interactions. And later, he also found out that due to that, you can re-enter and skew shares to assets because the shares all are already accounted to your account, but you did not pay any Ether yet. So yeah, attack that was rather, like, I would not want to say simple, but I guess that if it was Code Arena, it would be found. I'm sure of that. But what struck me personally in this story was the Hoshiari, when he found this out, he wrote a POC verifying that this is working, and he wrote to the protocol, and they didn't reply in like few minutes. So he decided that he will contact Seal 911, which was, I don't know if you know, dear listeners, but yeah, Seal 911 is an initiative from Sam Cicisson and all the other all-stars concerning Web3 security. And what they are doing, they are trying to prevent hacks. So he reached out to guys from Seal 911, and like literally in 48 hours since he wrote to Seal 911, the protocol already fixed the bug. So in less than an hour, the bug was fixed.
That's crazy.
Yeah, how often do you hear about this story?
That's amazing.
I mean, like, out of all the relatively like new stuff coming out, like, in my opinion, the Seal 1-1 initiative is probably one of the coolest. It's a really cool concept. But like, one thing I was kind of curious about is, so they have very fast response times. How do they prevent people from sending in essentially random nonsense that to slow them down and stuff like that? Do they have stuff in like place to prevent that?
Damn, I'm not sure. Like,
yeah, I'm not too sure myself, to be honest. Interesting question.
Because that's definitely one of the strongest points, is how fast they are at response. And you know, that's definitely something that they should look into, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe they have some kind of light chaser, but for contacting everyone.
I think it's also like a matter of how serious the security is to a project. I feel like the more serious the project takes security, the better their response time will be in terms of fixing bugs and whatnot. Because the projects that don't really care, you'll see that you don't tend to see such quick fixes, for instance. Whereas on ones that do care about security, you know, it's like having multiple audits, right? Some projects will literally have an audit like every month, every 3 months or something, or as soon as they do like a big change. And some projects will just, you know, for instance, do the complete opposite. So I do feel like it's kind of also dependent to the project, but I mean, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, like, one far-fetched dream that I have, not anytime soon, but is getting Light Chaser to a point where it can be part of, it can be just part of like a cool initiative like Seal 911. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I will slowly work towards as well. Like, because if I can actually like help preemptively spot other vulnerabilities which may also exist, let's say a particular like fix, I think that'd be quite useful potentially.
That would be a nice objective. We also have Woofy, which is a decentralized exchange on the Arbitrum network. They were exploited via a flash loan attack, which resulted in a total loss of 8.5 million. Again, very sad. And another flash loan. Wow. The attacker manipulated Wufi's price oracle by using flash loans to just artificially inflate the value of the Wu tokens, which allowed them to drain the Wu PPV2 pool through free, let's just say, strategic swaps. Luckily, though, the team responded quickly and they paused the contracts that were affected within 13 minutes. That's pretty good as it just relates to the conversation that we had. And they offered a 10% bounty to the attacker, who was apparently a white hat hacker. I wouldn't say a white hat. I would probably say gray hat at most. But yeah, quite interesting.
Flash loans, though. That's the fastest I've ever seen.
30 minutes. That is impressive, to be honest. Very impressive. I did have a specific note that was relating to this specific scenario. I just need to find it.
Yeah, so maybe the gray hat was the developer. So first he exploited the contract. Then he verified that it really drained the protocol. And then he immediately paused it.
Oh, yes, this is the note I had saved. So can you guess who they were audited by? Impossible challenge.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they were audited. Well, their swap and Oracle contracts were audited in October 22 by Certik. But then, however, they did have a bug bounty on Immunify in 2022 as well. That did include their Woo Oracles, but apparently the results aren't public. So we don't actually know. I'm assuming that never got picked up, clearly. And other bugs did. But yeah, it is quite sad. I do think this flash loan attack was also paired with Oracle manipulation, but there is not like too crazy details around this. Yeah, it was manipulating the Wu price. But yeah, I mean, yeah, this does seem like it was tied with the Wu Oracle. And I think they had an audit on C4 as well, did they not? Wufi? It rings a bell.
Well, I don't remember ever seeing that project.
Yeah, I think they were. Because I remember the Wu Oracle, but... Okay, maybe they were. Maybe it was a project that was using Wu Oracles, but I don't know. But yeah.
Like, another really cool thing about Seal. Like, I don't know if, like, Seal wasn't, like, involved in this one. Mm-hmm. But they also do war games, I believe. So they kind of, like, do simulated, like, attack scenarios with protocols.
Mm.
And I think because of that, I'm hoping that the reaction time will only go down from here. Like it'd be even faster.
Yeah,
that's something that you've heard of as well. That's really cool. That's like a Web 2 thing that's been implemented into Web 3.
Yeah, so definitely. Because cool. Response time is like one of the major things that you get taught in cybersecurity in Web 2. It's very, very important. Extremely. Because it mainly relates to like ransomware incidents, for instance. You know, if a network gets pwned by a ransomware on a corp network, then yeah, you've got a very, very big problem. And that's why speed is so important. But yeah, the same logic applies to Web3. And I just found out that what I was just saying regarding Wufi, they had an audit on Sherlock actually in March this year. So yeah, it was Sherlock, not C4. That's where I recognized the Wu Oracle from.
Okay, so probably they had an audit just after the hack happened.
Yeah.
To make sure that there is nothing left there. And yeah, like concerning what to do when you get hacked, like it's super easy. Just follow your playbook. But no one actually has the playbook for this kind of scenarios. Yeah, duh.
I think this is like a really powerful like reason why you like having a pausing mechanism can be so useful. Is that like if a breach is detected, you can temporarily just pause the contract. But sadly, I personally have seen pausing mechanisms being implemented pretty poorly in the past. So even though protocols use the pausable library, the way that they implement it also needs to be checked, because I have quite a few detectors that try to detect this. A lot of the times I've seen contracts that inherit the pausable library, but they never actually expose the pause or unpause functions, because those are internal by default. So a lot of times their functions correctly have the when not paused modifiers applied to them, but when a breach happens, they still can't pause it because they never expose those functions. And I think it was this year, a recent hack happened that wasn't preventable because of that exact issue.
Yeah, so like, damn, like the worst part is that those issues are not like very hard to find. And no. Why still people hire Certik of these kind of things.
Yeah, I wonder if it was actually Certic at fault, but you know.
Okay, gonna bet $5 on that.
I'm hoping that automation helps stomp out things like this, because, like I mentioned, automation is quite good at setting a bot.
Definitely.
So I think that the more protocols become used to what automation is capable, I'd say the higher the bar will go, which will prevent protocols from getting subpar orders in the future, which is something I'm really hoping for and looking forward to.
I definitely agree. It would be a very nice bonus to the scene.
Cool. And the last topic for today, we have Unizen, which it's the centralized exchange suffered a significant security breach, and they lost $2 million due to an exploit of their upgraded aggregation contract. And when I see like aggregation contracts, aggregators, routers, damn, like we have so many of them, like all the time. And like the most important thing, do not allow user to call like any functions. Have some limitation, like do not allow user to call like any contract with any call data that they wish to anyone, because it may be like ERC-20 that the user puts approvals for, and the attacker can you know just take all the funds that user approved to the contract. Actually, like one of the contests I recently did had this exact vulnerability, and I was like, what the fuck? Like, what else do we need to prevent from such kind of attacks?
I think also aggregators and routers and whatnot, they're always kind of a hot target for black hats, if you think about it, because some of those contain a lot of juicy logic, let's just say. So it's always like a point of just attack, really.
Mm-hmm. And like I'm wondering here, because the stuff that we are discussing here, they are repeatable. So for example, when Kankodu found this stealth donation attack, like immediately a few protocols got hacked because of that. When he made it public, like this Unizen thing, when you have router, all the kinds of issues, like one person found issue with ERC-433, if I'm not mistaken, that I think that it had this exact issue. And then like we have tons of vulnerabilities of such sort. And I'm thinking if maybe there are some actors out there that are creating automations for the issues that they read. So for example, they go to Twitter, they see this new kind of attack, and they look, you know, how they can generalize that. And then, you know, just plow through all the contracts that are out there, you know, maybe, you know, automatically detect them, or just to create some kind of point of interest for themselves for manual analysis. How feasible is that? What do you think, Chase?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So that is sadly quite feasible, because if you actually look at the recent hacks, especially in this batch that we talked about today, it tends to be the same handful of vulnerabilities that get exploited. So if you have know-how and you can generalize and abstract it to a level where you can apply it to multiple protocols despite protocol specific logic, then it is sadly quite feasible to just automatically detect all of the, as a black hat, detect all of the contracts which have this vulnerability and exploit accordingly. I'd say it is possible, and the counterplay to that is making, like, especially open source security tools more readily available with more detectors, because then the protocols themselves can preemptively defend themselves against these common attack vectors. Yeah, that's my feeling on it.
Yeah, like, totally agree. And I think that, you know, this being said, we can finish today's episode. Like, guys, I hope you like it. It was super insightful. I really loved all the topics we touched here today. Cool, thanks a lot.
Same. I loved it a lot. Chase, thank you for being on here as well. You explained everything very nicely, very coherent. I loved it. Thank you.
Honestly, I thought I would just rambled on and on too much. But I appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. Take care.